Between 1946 and 1956, over 15,000 scrolls and scroll fragments were discovered in caves on the shore of the Dead Sea. These scrolls provide a fascinating insight into how magic and evil spirits were thought of in Judea around the time of Jesus. Hello, my name is Gareth Edwards, and welcome to the Untitled History Podcast. Join me each week alongside world-leading experts as we take a deep dive into your favorite topics from throughout history. From the ancient world to the modern, and with plenty of historical rabbit holes in between, we'll cover famous and not-so-famous moments in history from all across the globe. The period of the Second Temple was a time of cultural change for Jewish communities, including in how they regarded concepts such as magic and demons. But evidence for what that meant on the ground was limited until the discovery of the first scrolls in 1946 and the wealth of scholarship that followed. The picture painted is of a society looking to understand how the world and the beliefs of other cultures around them should be considered in relation to the Hebrew Bible and beyond. With me today to discuss all of this, and probably beings such as howlers, yelpers, and spirits of the Angel of Destruction, is Tupa Guerra, and I apologize because I absolutely will butcher the name, but say hello, Tupa.
Hello, and don't worry about the name. it's hard to pronounce, I know.
Feel free to butcher mine English. In return. But you are, of course, you are, of course, a Brazilian historian specializing in Demons of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is absolutely why I wanted you on. You have a PhD from the University of Birmingham, and you're also a public historian who records podcasts as well since about 2015, I think, although most of those are in Portuguese, I believe.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I've been podcasting since my PhD, and I fell in love with the idea of bringing knowledge from the academic circles to more the general public, which is precisely what we're doing here. And I think it's, I won't say the way forward, but it's very important. And I don't think all scholars need to do it, but some do need to. And it's very nice to be able to talk about it, all the details and weird things we like.
And that's exactly why, like, when we talked around maybe doing one around this, I was like, yeah, we really should, because I think this is such a sort of unknown aspect. People might have heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and we'll give a bit more context in a second, but they probably don't realize really what the insights it gives us are. So just to set the context very quickly for listeners, as I mentioned, you know, think of these as fragments of scrolls that were discovered over a period of about 10 years between 1946 and 1956. And they're in the Qumran Caves, which is on the northern shore of the Dead Sea. And who left these scrolls behind is still a bit of an unknown, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. And that's fascinating because when we found out, and I joke, when people found the scrolls, and there is this very cute story, which we think that this is a story, not necessarily how it happened, about a goat that got lost and got into one of the caves, and then the guy who was taking care of her found the scrolls. And there is this part that I hate that says, oh, he had no idea what the scrolls were. So, and I think it's important to notice that he had some idea that there were ancient texts and they had value because he got the scrolls to Jerusalem to be sold. So it's not like he had no idea what he was doing. Anyway, of course, he was not a scholar in. But we have no idea why the scrolls are there. And there were plenty of theories around the years. And at the beginning, the most common theory was about the Essenes, which is supposed to be a community of this monk-like type of community, only with men. And they would gather in the desert and they would be this isolated group. But when we look at the scrolls and when we look at the things like there's some people who did research on the material for the jars and other aspects of the thing. And you can see that we have connections from other areas. So it's not an isolated community. It might be kind of isolated, but not totally isolated. And other than that, we are not sure if these scenes actually existed. So sorry, Jörg.
And I think that's it. And this is one of those things that really emphasizes the mystery around this. And it's the contents we've been able to look into, but like the fragment, the fact that a lot of these are fragments in themselves, this is a fragmentary history. It gives us almost like momentary spotlights into certain aspects of that time. But those aspects actually in some ways are things that we didn't really know about at all. I mean, one of the things I've learned about studying this period over the years is actually sometimes the archaeological record for this stuff in this period is way more fragmentary than we might think. We have good evidence for sort of 200 years before what we call the area surrounding the birth of Christ, and good archaeology for 300 years after and heading into the medieval period for what Jewish communities were thinking around this. But weirdly, in this kind of aspect of the stuff the scrolls cover, this is actually one of our primary sources for knowledge about how those communities thought about spirituality and mysticism and how they related it to their own religion. I mean, that's my understanding of it. Is that correct, or are you about to absolutely put me out of my misery?
No, it's correct. And it's interesting because people often say that the scrolls are this window to the past. In a way they are, but we have to remember that they are a collection of texts that someone or someone's put together in the caves. So they are not a reference to all the things in the period. They are, of course, a reference to some of the things and a selection of things that people at some point wanted to keep. So that's one very important part of the scrolls. The other thing is they are very fragmentary, as you said. They are around 15,000 fragments that make around 900 texts. So it's some of the texts I worked with, they are all, I call my texts, they are all very fragmentary. You have like, one of them have, I think like it's 200 pieces of scraps. And you also have this beautiful, beautiful scrolls like the Great Isaiah Scroll, which is amazingly well preserved and you can read most of it. So it's fascinating to have this. It's also a very new field of study, which doesn't feel like, because we're talking about 70 years, but the last publication of the academic publication for the scrolls, it's from 2009. And most scholars just had access to the entirety of the corpus by the beginning of the 2000s, late 1990, early 2000s. So it is a quite new field of study. And it kind of flips the logic from what historians tend to work, because we tend to consider the context to think about the texts. And we don't have the context, as you said. I mean, we have a general idea of the context, but we don't have that much of specifics. And we do have Josephus, which brings a lot of interesting points for this, but we have to consider who Josephus was. And just very quickly for the audience, because I'm not sure if people know who Josephus is. He's a Jewish scholar and kind of historian from the period, but he worked for the Romans and he worked for the dynasty that took over and was actually responsible for destroying the temple. So he's amazing and funny, and I say amazing because it's really great to have what he said about things, but he's famously not very reliable in a lot of things. So we do have this, but the scrolls are, as you said, they are the biggest corpus we have to speak about the period. So we have to take little bits and pieces and try to reconstruct what people would think about those, about spirituality and about, I would say, philosophy, because we tend to think about philosophy only for the Greeks, and we call them the sapiential texts, and they're mostly philosophy as well. So the scrolls are this, I love the scrolls, so yeah.
I think that's the thing. It's like, and listeners, if you're wondering, like, how are these things preserved? It's almost like, we've talked on the podcast before in the context of Rome about the Vindolanda letters being preserved up in the north of Britain. And these are obviously like letters in Roman times preserved on Hadrian's Wall. And they're preserved because they're stuck in a peat bog. And it's almost like this is the exact opposite of that. Now, these documents often survive because of a combination of the arid air in the area, that there's very low airflow in those caves, and also that much of the material that these scrolls were written on, that these are written on, wasn't properly kind of cured. It's parchment that wasn't properly cured. And that meant there's not as much of a chemical reaction going on, as well as many of them being stored and found in jars. So it's just, I love it because it's just such a remarkable bit of history that we've got, almost purely by chance, both in terms of discovery and in terms of how it happened to be preserved. But maybe what would be useful, if you don't mind, is just, you touched on it a bit with talking about philosophy. In the broadest terms, what do these fragments generally cover?
Okay, so they are all, I mean, all, most of them are religious texts. They are Jewish religious texts. And they, some of them are part of what Christians call now the Old Testament. There is nothing from what we call now the New Testament, which is very interesting. And people tend to get confused with that. But we don't have any evidence for texts like the New Testament, but we do have very similar type of texts because they are in the same period of time or similar period, 100 years around. But also we have a variety of texts that try to understand the biblical text. I say biblical, but it wasn't biblical back then. It was just religious. And so we have, for instance, the Pesharim, which are texts that comment on the other texts. And those are, I love that, because you can see what people from the Second Temple period, what they were thinking about the other texts that were older for them too. So you can have a very interesting feel of how people were interpreting things and how they were thinking about society and life and the other world, or what will happen when you die, what types of dangers you have in your life, and so on. So it's really interesting to get this feel of it. And of course, we have a very, very tiny portion of texts that are a bit different. There is some inscriptions in Latin that might have been produced by Romans later. And of course, we are not sure of who messed up with the caves around, because we tend to say, oh, they were there for 2,000 years, but we're not totally sure. Maybe someone got there at some point and did something. And also, very interesting, we call the Dead Sea Scrolls actually a bigger group than the Quran texts. So I don't know if people saw some news like 3 or 4 years ago, I think, that they said, oh, we found new Dead Sea Scrolls. So we tend to, scholarly, you call Dead Sea Scrolls all scrolls found in the vicinity of the Dead Sea, because historians are very logical in their names. And then, and of course, so the Qumran texts are what we're talking about today. The other texts, they are a bit later and they have letters and other interesting things. But yeah, it's mostly religious texts, and we have different copies of the same text with differences between the texts, which made us think very hard of what's happening there. And also we have some texts that are the rules of a community. And that's why people thought it was this Essenes, and they made the connection. Because the first texts to be published, they were these rules of community, and they talk about the community that exclusive for men. And so sometimes we call this, we don't like to use the Essenes because we're not sure they existed. So we use the Yahad, which is the term for community, but we also can use, I prefer to use the idea that the community related to the text, because I don't subscribe to the idea that those texts were exclusive to this community. And I think they might have a connection to the broader way of thinking in the period. But yeah, religious texts from 2000 years.
I heard another academic once describe it, and very loosely, as imagine like in like a 2000 years, discovering the remnants of an internet forum that was about religion. You know, you're getting yeah. kind of like the rules, you find the community rules post, you find some of the notes on like, you know, different posts that have been up, and then the discussion beneath them and all of that. And that you'd never be able to form an entire picture from that of what that community was about. But it just gives you little windows into the ways they were thinking at different times. And I've always stuck with me as an analogy, because it just feels a bit right, you know, for giving your listeners a bit of an idea of this. Like, we're not talking that these are reams and reams of coherent and consistent, uninterrupted text laying everything out. So much of the scholarship work around this is almost literally pulling fragments together and going, well, this one relates to this and all of that. So there's a lot of detective work in it, isn't there?
Yeah, that's part of why I love it, because it's the feeling that you get when you spend like months looking into something and then you find another text that have a similar word and you can connect them, and oh, it's amazing. But other than that, I know that some people, many years ago, I watched a paper on people were using the ways they analyze Twitter to analyze some of the scrolls, because Twitter is also like this loosely, you don't have, I mean, Twitter, old thing, not X weird thing. So same idea. And I really like this idea of like getting, yeah. And imagine you have most of the files corrupted and you have just bits and parts and bits of things, and then you have to connect them. But actually we can find a lot. And because we say like that, and sometimes people feel it's, oh, so you're just guessing. And no, we actually have quite a lot of information from there.
So let's talk a bit about some of the insights they give us, because we've talked very loosely about them being, in inverted commas, religious. And it's probably worth, maybe, if you don't mind, setting a scene for when we say religious, we're not just talking sort of the, okay, what, how does this relate to the study of what we, in Christian terms, we call the Old Testament and the New Testament. We're talking sort of impact on daily life and spirituality in a way, almost, with this as well, because those things are the same at the time.
Yeah. This separation we have today, which is the way societies, especially in the Western, tend to exist, is that religion and spirituality are one thing and life is another thing. So we separate them. And we don't see the separation on the text. We see those two things really, really connected. As people are living, the debates on religion are part of what they fear in their daily lives. And so the text can, they bring this debate to us. And they also are trying to understand how to better follow the laws of God. They are trying to understand how God, what God wants for them. Because another interesting thing is a lot of the texts are poetry. And poetry is famously difficult to interpret. And there is a lot of beautiful analogies and things like that. And then for the daily life, if you're supposed to follow those rules to be saved and to be safe, how do you follow the rules if you don't understand them? So you do have this idea of a lot of people trying to get what is to follow God. And what are the dangers? And how do we exist in this world? And how do we make sense of life? And for me, that's very much what we get from the scrolls, is this idea. And another thing that's interesting to think, and some people had proposed that the scrolls are actually the library of the Jerusalem temple. And this is a minority of people. I don't really think that's what's happening here. But we tend to think about religion in our days as something very centralized and very organized in just one way. And that's not what's happening in antiquity. We can see that's a lot of ways to practice religion in antiquity, even if you subscribe to the same religion. And of course, we do have the Jerusalem temple, which centralized the cult and the way things would happen. But there is other temples and other ways to do things. And the scrolls have a lot of debate if we should go to the temple in Jerusalem or not. And there's a lot of text saying, oh no, the temple was defiled and we shouldn't go there because the priests are corrupt and we should do other things. So you can see this tension of society and how people were, like the political debates and how they are existing in this thing. And that's why I think the scrolls bring to us not only the views of a very isolated community, but some of the views can be applied to a more general sense of the society.
Yeah, they're sort of reflective of, you know, even if we're only getting the far ripples, we're still getting the ripples of a thing that happens somewhere else. And I think that's exactly why these are fascinating, certainly to me. It's because this is a particularly fascinating and critical time as well. Because obviously this is Roman Judea we're talking about this time. This is the Second Temple period. But one thing I love that really comes through in, and I wish I could read Hebrew. I wish I could see them in the original. I'm stuck with translations. And obviously they're not all written in Hebrew either, are they? The various languages as well. But I think one thing I'm always struck by is that, as you say, the blend of the community aspect and just how there is no boundary between the religious aspect, the spiritual aspect, and the daily life aspect. So some of those community rules, for example, are like, yeah, this is how you join the community. This is who will be let into this community. This is also how you purify someone when they join to make sure they don't have any evil spirits in them. Like, and that's just part of almost the joining instructions. It's not like it's a separate aspect. That's just, they're all just wedded together as a single thing. And I find that fascinating.
And it's because I think it's very hard for us to notice how things can be so much integrated between the spiritual side and like practical life, because we don't tend to do that. Enlightenment and all those things. Although I'm Brazilian, so Brazil tends to see religiosity and some spiritual aspects a bit different from England. It was really interesting to live in another country because in Brazil, we learn a lot about how we are very European. That's part of what we are taught in school and colonization and all of the things. So we are like, oh yeah, we are very European. So in a way, although you know it's not very European, when you go to Europe, you kind of expect to be very similar. And then I got to England and I was like, oh, you guys are very different. Interesting. And in my experience, in England, people are way more separate from spiritual and religious things than we are in Brazil. Although I'm not a religious person myself, but I grew up seeing a lot of expressions of religion. And what we see in the scrolls is very much this, because we tend to separate anxiety that we have and fear that we have from the spiritual world. It's, oh no, it's not, it's a spiritual thing. It's not something in daily life. And what we see in the scrolls is that fear is something, you fear evil in your life, in your daily life. So you have to do things to protect yourself in the same way as if you go out in your, I try to work out this for people in England. It's really hard because in Brazil, I can translate better. But it's like if you go out of your house, you do take some precautions, like you lock your door. And for us, this is a very real thing. But praying to avoid evil things is the same logic. It's exactly the same logic. It's a very palpable thing. And we tend to think about it as different and not that important. But in the scrolls, you see that, no, for them, it was similar things. They were difficult in the same way. And you have to be worried about evil in the same way as you lock your door.
And I think you're absolutely right there. And like, listeners, if you want to wow your mates with a bit of terminology here, what we're talking about here is, I'm always terrible at pronouncing these words again, because I'm always pronouncing them this wrong. But this, we're talking about effective, what is, is it apotropaic prayers? Effectively, it's apotropaic. The idea that, yes, that you effectively, in the same way as like you say, like you'd lock your door as you leave your house, or set your home, you know, your home burglar alarm. What we find in the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, of here is the prayer you say when you're going out, because it just makes sure that the demons and spirits can't get you while you're out and about doing things. Here is the prayer you say when you're with someone who's in childbirth, because you need to make sure Lilith doesn't show up and do nasty things. You know, these are precautionary measures in the same way as we have things. But we also find in these scrolls, we find incantations as well, which is almost the opposite side. It's like, well, you forgot to say your prayer that kept the yowler away from you. So now you need to go to someone who's going to do an incantation, which is what will get the yowler out of you. And it's so every day that, like, listeners, I really want you to get the idea that when people talk about Dead Sea Scrolls and the content of them, this is the kind of thing that you find in them, is that they are just almost like everyday actions through a window that we don't really often see the world through anymore.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to try to understand, because we talk about, oh no, it's everyday things, so, but it's not clear in the text. They don't say to us like, oh, in this time pray this, in this time pray this. So we have to make a lot of connections and trying to understand how would they protect themselves? Because they talk about a danger thing. And that's one of the things during my PhD, that's one of my favorite conclusions from the PhD, is this idea that what we see in the scrolls is an atmosphere of fear. It's like this idea that evil and danger, they are always present. And they can always befall you, which is one of the terms they use in the scrolls to talk about people who were attacked by something. So the befallen. It gives you this idea that doesn't matter what you do, something can come up to you at some point. And you have to be vigilant all the time. And the way to be vigilant all the time is to follow the laws of God. And some of the texts may be used in more than one way. So we like to separate incantations and prayers and things as if they are very, very separate. But apparently, from what we can see in the text, they are not that separate. They are kind of mingled together. So there is a prayer that you can say, but at the same time, this prayer can, having the text written down may have some protection as well. So having the text with you or in your house would be something that helped you to avoid evil and so on. So you have this complex system of existing. Of course, there are times of the day which are more dangerous. And the night, of course, the night is always the horrible one, mostly because humans don't see in the dark, no? So we are scared of things we cannot see. But we do have all those transitional times. So when the day is beginning and when the day is ending, the midday, and also, so it reflects these moments of transition in days, but also it's likely that moments in transition of life, so birth, marriage, and other moments would be dangerous because you're more, maybe you're changing the way society sees you and so on. So that's why you're more exposed to evil.
Yeah, I think one thing I love and comes through both in a lot of the scholarship even is one of those things that the more we change as a species, the more we stay the same. It's really easy to sometimes think of our ancestors as stupid, and they're not stupid. That they just don't have the cumulative knowledge we do as a society. They're still trying to find the same solutions. They're still facing similar problems. And the scrolls and what we see from them, and what we've just talked about here, as you've talked about the different stages of life and all of those things, they're trying to make sense of those things and go, well, actually, let's see what works. Let's see how we safeguard against these things. What's our insurance against it? What do we do if something's gone wrong? Those are very normal and real thoughts that everyone has now. We're just operating in a different context. And that's why it's so interesting to me.
Yeah, you said something that I always tell people. They say that people in the past, they were not stupid. They were not devoid of logic. And they just follow different parameters and they understood the world from different lenses, but they were as logical as we are. It's very important to know that, because one of the things with evil in general and demons in general, I don't use the term demons, because demons have this very much this idea of our idea of this horned red thingy that attacks people. So during my, I prefer to use evil beings. Then we can put more evil in it. They are trying to understand why bad things happen to good people. Why does an infant died when it didn't nothing wrong? It's an infant. And all the other anxieties that we have. Another thing that's really interesting is to see how evil is connected to disease. And I say that this brings a very corporeal thing, a very corporeal idea to evil, because evil is something that really affects you. It makes you sick. It can make you die. So you have to find protection against it. And people often tend to think about that and think, oh, no, they're stupid. They didn't understand disease. Okay, they might not understand it from the perspective we understand today, but they have a pretty good idea that, oh, if this person is sick, you shouldn't put this person with other people because the other people will also get sick. They cannot understand that. But they also are trying to say, okay, what can I do to prevent this from happening to my family? And that's why they will have prayers and protections and amulets and so on as a way to, yeah, we're trying to understand it. Because we have this logic that comes from numbers and this idea that, oh, if you're good, good things happen to you. If you're bad, bad things happen to you. But as we all know, it doesn't apply to real life because plenty of horrible things happen to great people when great things happen to very terrible people. So it's a way to make the world make sense, maybe.
Well, it's like the old saying that like the biggest threat to a medieval king is an ear infection. Like that, yeah. You're more likely to die of an ear infection than you are in battle if you're a medieval king. Something you mentioned there I want to actually really dig into a bit because I think it's really worth it, which is, as you say, like we've used the word demon here as in Christian terms in particular, and actually in later medieval Jewish and beyond terms, that's a very loaded term. And it's not like a direct translation really from the text. There are many ways we could translate what they're talking about. I think spirits is the one that I've seen particularly used. I think it's B.H. Reynolds who uses spirits a lot. I will include some links in the show notes, listeners, to interesting articles and things for those who want to read more. But one of the things that I've seen touched upon in scholarship is also that just as much as they're trying to understand the world, the people who are writing these and reading these elements that we've got fragments of, they're also trying to understand the cultures and societies around them. Because we're in a period where Jewish communities have been in exile at various points within recent history in this period. They spent times in close contact and in places like Persia and beyond. And you've got some sort of Akkadian influences that come in. And it's always struck me slightly that there seems to be an element of going, well, this is our God and our religious text, but all these other communities have these different gods and different religious texts. And how does their stuff fit into our stuff? That always feels to me that something that comes through. I don't know if you want to talk about that a bit, maybe.
Yeah, precisely, because what we see in the Dead Sea Scrolls are not demons in the way we understand today. That's why I decided to go away from this idea of demon. Actually, demon is a very complex term because it has been used in a variety of ways along history. And a lot of people like to bring the daimon thing and say, oh, no, demons were... In ancient times, all demons are understood as good and bad at the same time. And I'm like, no, in this particular time, in Greece, during this period, yes. But they're always kind of mischievous. They are always... And they also have this idea, the term demon tend to be used to describe things that... beings that can communicate between the humans and the otherly world. And variety of capacities. And in the scrolls, we don't have one term to define demon. We have a lot of terms. The Howlers of the Night is one of my favorite.
I love the Howlers. Let's talk Howlers for a second. Describe Howlers to listeners.
I think one of the fascinating things is we don't know what animal they might represent. We know they make a list of terrible things that can attack you. And there is this Howlers of the Desert that they can attack you. And we don't know what they are. And there's plenty of studies trying to connect them to some animals and to some things that can attack you. We don't know. We just know they made a terrible sound and make you feel horrible.
My headcanon is very much now as someone who lives in London and is used to urban foxes. That every time I hear an urban fox, you know, howling away in the night, I'm like, oh, that's those Howlers from the Dead Sea Scrolls coming at me again.
Yeah. You see? You're in danger. You need to do some apotropaic things.
Exactly. I need to get my prayers in.
Yeah. But yes, it's this, they use a variety of terms and spirit is one of them. But it's interesting because spirit by itself, the word ruach, it doesn't explain it all. But usually you need to bring what else it says. So spirits can be a great thing and can be a horrible thing. So you have spirits of bastards, which are terrible, but you can have spirits of knowledge, which is great. And you want spirits of knowledge around you. So I wouldn't say just spirits, because that's why I like to put the evil together with the word, because the spirits itself, they don't translate everything. And ruach can also mean breath and can mean like soul, as we understand today, so plenty of things. And also we have, so you mentioned Lilith before, and I'm one of the people who are a bit skeptical about the Lilith mentioned in the scrolls, although there is one mention of Liliths And I think it's more like a category of beings and not necessarily one being, because it was more common in antiquity to think about Liliths as a category of terrible beings. Usually they you have Lilithes and Lilithus, so you have the male and the female. And the female tend to attack infants and give them poison milk. We have to remember that infant mortality was one of the highest ways of people dying in ancient times. So it makes a lot of sense for a society to think about what type of evil is trying to attack women and children. And other than that, so we have the Lilithes, we have the spirits of the bastards, we have the howlers of the desert, you have the... There is more spirits.
Yeah, well,
spirits
one of the ones.
Destruction.
Yeah, one of my favorite ones, and knows exactly that, is the spirits of destruction. Because similar to what you were saying there about, like, how do we connect these things to things like to the idea of, say, Lilith, we've talked about as a classification of spirits that have negative impacts on children, on mothers, is a lot of people have always jumped historically to go, there's the mention of the spirit of the angel of destruction. Well, that's Satan. That's Satan. That's Beelzebub.
No.
And it's like, no. Like, you've got to step back and think about these things as a category. And it's much broader than that, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's, when you look at the scrolls, one thing I did during my PhD was to look into those many, many types of evil things that can attack people. And I wanted to understand if they made a separation between evil things that are non-corporeal and can attack you, and evil people. And apparently they don't, which is very interesting, because you have the lot of Belial and the Sons of Darkness, and those groups that are supposed to attack the good ones, which would be the god people. And anyway, so those groups, when they talk about them, it's not that they don't differentiate between non-corporeal beings and corporeal beings, but the lot of Belial or the Sons of Darkness includes spirits of destruction and Kitim, like foreigners. They put them together in the same group. They are acting together. I think it's fascinating to think about those things as all different types of evils that can attack you. So praying can also help you against the people who can attack you in the streets and rob you. And
but this is back to what you were saying in the beginning about, like, this is all under an umbrella of how do I deal with fear? Like, and fear can be both physical, it can be psychological, it can be of the unknown, it can be of an unknown person. And I love that all of this stuff is about kind of trying to reconcile with that and go, how do we deal with that? I am going to give a shout out to Yelpers. We haven't mentioned Yelpers. This entire thing, listeners, if you are looking to start a death metal band and you are not sure what to call yourself, find yourself a good text on the fragments of the Dead Sea Scrolls, because you will find some amazing, absolutely amazing death metal band names in there. Like, if there isn't already a Spirit of the Angels of Destruction out there and they're doing Finnish death metal, I will be very, very surprised.
Yeah, we can make some suggestions of texts that people might use for death metal and black metal.
We'll do the death metal band, you know, the academic, there's an academic article for you. Death metal band named Origins and the Dead Sea Scrolls.
There is the metal ancient society. There's conferences on metal and ancient times and historians working on this. So they're great.
There you go. That's the Venn diagram overlap is huge.
yeah.
So one thing I do want us to touch on a bit is that in some ways, from what I've read, these scrolls act as a really nice sort of academic or philosophical bridge in seeing the development of how demons of evil spirits are seen in the Jewish faith, because how the evidence we have from how they were regarded in sort of pre-exile Jewish literature, so that period before this era, before the 0 BCE era, and how the Jewish faith looks on spirits and demons in the medieval era are very different. And that for a long time, we didn't really necessarily have a way of going, well, what's the path from one to the other? And from my understanding, the scrolls almost give us a bit of a window finally into that. Do you feel that's accurate?
Yeah, I do. And the scrolls, they, especially because of the huge amount of material we got with the scrolls. So I tend to say it's one of the biggest archaeological discoveries of the 20th century. And not just because, oh, because they are religious texts. No, it's because they give us so much to understand how those connections were made and how the fear, and you touched upon fear. Fear is one of the main concepts because you have the words for fear. There's more than one word for fear. Fear, dread, and so on, like we do in English. But it's used to say about how you feel about things, but also it's the fear of God that will take away the evil spirits from you. So fear has this double way of being used. And for some scholars, especially some Jewish scholars, they would say, oh, there is no demons or evil spirits in the Tanakh or in older texts. This doesn't exist. It's something later on. But then we look back into the text and you do have David and the playing the lyre to take away, to calm down Saul and so on. So we have something there, but we do not have what would say like an organized demonology. And that was what I was expecting when I started studying it. I was expecting to have like a D&D book of demons, and I would be it would be fun to look into, oh, this demon does that and this demon does that. And no, it didn't happen, because you can see that those texts are trying to make sense of things, and it's not a crystallized demonology yet. It will happen later, but in this time, it's this mismatched connection of things, and they're trying, as you said, oh, they've been in some of them being in exile, so they are bringing some references, but also there is commerce, there is people traveling, there is ideas crossing cities. We tend to think about ancient people was isolated in their own places, but actually there is a lot of travel, a lot of other things. So they are trying to understand the world, and they are trying to understand the reference that other peoples bring. And what are those gods? Are they really gods? Are they evil things? How do we connect those? And all of this, we can see in the scrolls, and we can see the debates and the different ways in which... So we don't have a coherent picture of demonology in the scrolls. You have each text kind of brings a different aspect and gives us this idea of... And that's also why I think it pertains to more than just a little sect in the desert. And I think it reflects a bit of all the debates that were also happening in the broader society at the time.
Yeah, I mean, to take your D&D sort of metaphor, it's almost like what we're getting a glimpse here in the Dead Sea Scrolls is into the early playtesting of what will later be the D&D book that comes with medieval Jewish belief. We're seeing that bridging of almost the classical world and the medieval world, and that mishmash is everything, exactly like you say, that like these are people coming into contact with different societies and different trading things that are very different, and going, well, there are things they are afraid of, continuing our fear analogy. They must be afraid of them for good reason. How do they align with what's in our texts already? Are they things we need to work out how we incorporate into our framework? Because obviously we don't want to be caught by those same things that are affecting them.
Yeah, and even in the older texts, we see the fear of the things you cannot see and diseases and things. So it's this idea of trying to protect and make the ones you love be safe. There's plenty of, and as you said, oh, people tend to go and, oh, the Prince of Darkness or whatever, so he's definitely Satan. And I'm like, no, this is a contemporary, it's a way we today reinterpreted the text. But what we see there, it's a lot of different types of evils that can, sometimes they are correct, they are together in the Sons of Darkness thing, which it's a great name for a band.
Yeah, that's straight into band name again there.
Yeah. But other than that, you can also have this... they are a huge group of things that are there amongst the Sons of Darkness. So they are not one type of thing that can attack you. And I always think about I don't know if you or the listeners have ever been to a place where you don't have electricity for a very long distance and everything feels a bit different. The sounds are louder during the night and the shadows are a bit more scary. Of course, if you've grown up in a place like this, you won't be as scared as like us from the city. But still, it brings a different perspective of how you can be scared of things in life.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a scout leader and I don't do a lot of it these days, but I don't have the chance. But I still, one of the things I always loved when I got a chance to do a lot of that, and still when I get to go out, is taking kids camping for the first time and taking them to camp in the woods, you know, on a very safe campsite in a woods where you're camped in a clearing and everything else. And just the detachment on that, you know, and as you say, that the first time they're out in night and you're in the woods and the noise and the level of darkness you get under the tree canopy, I do think that it's very rare that you don't get kids come away from that, seeing the natural world with a bit more respect, with a bit more wariness than maybe they went into it before. And I do think that is maybe one of those tiny little shards of where we still experience what the people who were writing these and reading these at the time would have been feeling.
Yeah, it's a very difficult part of being a historian that we cannot experiment. We cannot properly feel what people were feeling, but we have to do our best to bring more into your knowledge library to try to understand it. Because it's very easy to us, because humans do that. We just read the text and we're like, oh, yeah, I understood it. Like, one example I like to give, it's like, oh, it says prayer, so I know how to pray, so it's the same. But it's not, because it's ancient times. They might pray in a totally different way than what you think and expect. And that's a part that I love about being a historian. It's trying to always take my mind out of the automatic things and trying to understand things from the other perspectives.
And I think maybe the very last thing, and we'll do this very briefly, we'll probably touch on this a bit more in the extra bit at the end for subscribers. But like, we haven't really touched at all on the concept of what is inverted terms of magic and the idea of the elements of that that goes in this. We'll touch on that a lot for subscribers, so subscribers hang around for that. But for the main cast, I do want to just give one example that you find in this, and then you can talk a little bit about it, about the idea of magic and the place it has. But like, we do have evidence from what we've found that effectively you've got the equivalent of sort of almost recipe books of, in inverted commas, spells. It's not quite right the right word, but it fits. And it's just how much of those things are about curing things that we might take an aspirin for now. So like, you know, there's spells to do with, okay, you're really having trouble sleeping. Okay, here's some stuff that if you recite this in the right way or the right person recites it for you, you're going to sleep better at night. So I just wanted to make sure we get that into the main podcast, because it's back again to just how closely bound these things are into daily life. So what would be your 2-minute summary of that aspect? And we'll save the rest for subscribers.
I'll try my best. Yeah. So I think especially people who are religious get very scared when I say, oh, there is magic, oh, Jewish magic, because I got a lot of backlash in conferences, and I think people get very upset when I say every religion has some aspect of magic. But that's because I'm understanding magic in an academic way and not the way in which people would understand in the past. So if you said to someone, oh, you're doing magical things, people would probably be very upset with you. But when we look at it from our lens today, they are doing some acts and practical things in their daily lives to try to change the world around them. And that's what I'm classifying as magic. So we do have in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have one text, it's for Q460. And it's, I prefer to give the names of the scrolls by the numbers than by the names, because I think it's easier to find them this way. So it's usually called the booklet of magic, or there's some, I'm not sure if it was a recipe book. I have my concerns about this idea of recipe book, but it is something that is written down and can help to protect you against evil. And we are not sure if it was only the recitation of it, or maybe it was important to keep the text, because it's one of the things that people say, oh, we don't find materia magica in the scrolls. So we don't find like twigs or pots or the magic balls that we find later in Jewish context. And I'm like, yeah, but we do have scrolls. They might be magical themselves, like the writing down and the text itself, because the text is very important. So it's likely that people were doing things to protect themselves. It's likely that some of the scrolls were used in this way, kind of an amulet or something like that. But it's something I didn't have time to explore much yet, but it's interesting.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's been absolutely wonderful. And we'll carry on chatting in a bit more for subscribers in a second. Where can people find more of your work? Where, if they want to know more about this, we'll obviously include some show notes, but where can they find more about you and your work?
First of all, thank you very much for having me. It's always lovely to talk about what we study for so long. It's always a happy moment. So I do have a podcast in Portuguese. So if someone who's listening to us knows Portuguese, you can find me at Uma Tupá no Tempo, which means a Tupá, which is me in time, in the sense of like traveling in different periods, which is my history podcast. I also have social media in general. You can find me at Tupá Guerra, which is TupaGuerra. And I tend to post in Portuguese and English, especially because I have a lot of friends from the UK, and from other places in the world. So I want it to be accessible so people can find me there. And yes, sometimes I do podcasts in English as much as I can. So yeah.
Well, we'll link to them when you do. And listeners, don't forget, if you've enjoyed this, do spread the word. Rate us, comment on YouTube, comment on Spotify. Those are the things that push podcasts into the feeds of other people who may not have heard of the podcast before, and then they get to discover it as well. But also, don't forget to join us as a subscriber. You can do that at untitled-history.com, and then you get to hear the inevitable discussion of more excellent death metal band names that we're about to have. But you get more things on there, like more extra bits from all our podcasts, ad-free episodes, various exciting things coming up that we're doing on there. But again, just spread the word. Shout out to the listener who told me the other day that their chiropractor is now a listener because they kept banging on about some of the stuff that they were doing. So shout out to that listener and their chiropractor. But yeah, look, seriously, WhatsApp people. You see a friend, you're chatting in the pub, tell them about a thing you heard and that you enjoyed. Spread the word of the Dead Sea Scrolls and how awesome they are and how important they are. And if you're a subscriber, hang around because we're going to carry on talking about them now. You've been listening to the Untitled History Podcast, a Battle Guide production. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to support the podcast, why not head over to our dedicated supporter page? There, for the cost of a cup of tea, you can decide which subjects we cover next, get access to exclusive behind-the-scenes content, and join a community of like-minded people. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.